You're listening to the Grand Salt Morning Show on KHZ Productions. If you enjoy this episode, please leave a like and comment. Hello, this is Jordan.
And Jared.
And Kale.
And Kate's in the room. We're recording at my house, and this is Grand Salt. We're going to be talking about just some general movie news that we've missed. I've been gone for a little while, but I've been on vacation, so that explains my absence. Hopefully you've been listening here with Kale, with the Youth Critic, to keep up with movie news. At the end of this episode, we'll also have an interview with Jeremy maybe another week. Sorry. We can go ahead on to it. So, let's talk about Jeremy Renner. That's who I was thinking of. Sorry. With Spawn. He may be joining the Blumhouse superhero movie. They may be rebooting that.
Finally.
Yeah, it was announced last year at Comic-Con, and Tom McFarlane was, last I heard, was writing and directing the movie.
The original. What was your thoughts on the original Spawn? You guys have any kind of opinion on that?
Not memorable.
Bad special effects.
It was a little rough. I have to say that. If it was made nowadays, and we have this chance to see it made nowadays, I think it'd be much better with actual special effects than what they try to get away with.
Well, then back then we also had the ye olde Daredevil movie, and yeah. We see what we've done with that now. With the writing is so much better,
and the one shots, and that's my dishwasher. Hopefully that ends in a second. There we go. And speaking of older actors, Billy Dee Williams is reprising his role of Lando Calrissian for the new Star Wars. What'd you guys, think of, I had a brain fart, the current Lando?
Donald Glover.
Donald Glover, there you go. What do you think of him? How do you think his portrayal went over?
He made the movie for me, aside from the little ending scene with my favorite Star Wars character. But I think that he'll be fine. I mean, he knows exactly who he's playing.
Yeah, it's just many years after, and I'm worried about his health. We've already lost, one Star Wars original cast. I don't want to shoot for a second one because of something happening.
Well, the good news is they're about to literally start filming this movie.
Yeah, but I mean, didn't Princess Leia's actor, didn't she die in the middle of filming?
No.
She got all of her parts finished, so whenever you see her, laying in the incubator, that's all CGI.
Gotcha.
Everything else that she's actually doing and talking is actually her.
Okay. I was curious about how they were going to do all that.
Yeah.
And Harrison Ford got hurt on one of the film sets, mm-hmm. So, I mean, we're dealing with
actors not gonna be in the
first day knees need to get on it.
Yeah, we're dealing with actors who are, no longer in their prime. They're still great actors, but they are older, and we gotta keep that in mind.
I mean, not everybody's Betty White.
Yeah, Betty White can just keep going forever.
Betty White is in her prime.
Betty White was in her prime whenever she was in the Golden Girls. She's still in her prime. She's got that
she's got that potty mouth grandma that I love so much.
That.
Sassy mouth.
Oh, what's the guy who plays Neo? What's his face? I'm terrible with names.
Keanu Reeves.
Keanu Reeves. I don't know why I'm so terrible with names. She's got the Keanu Reeves things going on. He's immortal. He has not aged any since he was first coming out.
He's aged a little bit, but not much.
He was in
makeup is good.
He was in his first couple films, and then he got to The Matrix, and then from there he has not aged. He just got slimmer.
Yeah, I mean, I saw him recently in the Point Break movie. All the way back. And I mean, I could tell he's aged a lot since then, but it's not much. His voice is a little bit more deeper, but yeah, it's not that much.
I'm excited for his movie he's doing with Winona Ryder. There you go. I'm so terrible.
Winona.
Is it the Destination lady. Wedding?
Yeah, the Destination Wedding.
It looks like so much fun.
It looks like it's going to be great. I love those kind of things where it's too actors who are not normally known for comedy coming together to do something funny. Speaking of that, did we review Tag last time we were on here?
No. We didn't. And I never did on the show.
So, we watched Tag, and we talked about this at breakfast as well. The movie was absolutely hilarious. I loved it. The actors were all great. It had a good cast, all of them memorable. I just really enjoyed it. What do you guys think?
I thought that it was a very, very good story. They did real... Crafty Apes.
Mm-hmm.
They did all of the VFX for it. Yeah, there were VFX in that movie. They showed us a little bit of like what happened in there, but I was overall very pleased with the movie. The story was good. The characters were great. I was really, really fond of the stoner guy.
And for a comedy, it had a good bit of action to it in the way they did it.
Oh, yeah.
They pulled off the Sherlock Holmes slow motion think it out stuff pretty well.
And I love that stuff.
Yeah.
Side note, that's also getting a sequel. New Sherlock.
A new Sherlock is getting a sequel?
Yeah, yeah, they've announced a sequel
to it. A
third movie
with
really?
Robert Downey Jr. Mm-hmm. And
yeah. Bob. And maybe Guy Ritchie to coming back.
I still think they missed an awesome opportunity in Infinity Wars for Robert Downey Jr.'s character and for Benedict Cumberbatch's characters to look at each other and someone say, "No shit, Sherlock."
Mm-hmm.
They both played him. They needed that line.
There's one more movie.
Yeah, there is one more movie. So I hope the writers are just like, you know what? We need to make an outside reference.
Mm-hmm. It might be too on the nose.
It would be so great.
The whole theater would erupt and start clapping.
Fangirling.
They had a really bad backlash with Beauty and the Beast and Harry Potter.
Really?
Yeah, because in the new Beauty and the Beast, Emma Watson made a time reference. And all the Harry Potter fans were like, no, Disney can't do that. So... Ever since then, Disney's been kind of hesitant to add any outside reference.
I know, but it's if you think about it, it's a saying that everybody has used at least once.
Like, but
no,
once
I get
a week.
That. But all the Sherlockians are going to be so pissed if anything else is like.
No, they'll be like, yeah.
Maybe,
also, I see Robert. I see Iron Man saying it to
Yeah. I see him saying to him.
It's a bit on the nose, but the thing is. Yeah, I don't care. I don't care. But yeah, Tag was good.
Speaking of other Marvel movies, we haven't really talked about Ant-Man. Only one of us in the room has seen it. Or two of us.
I've seen it.
Can you give us a non-spoiler review of it? Real quick.
Just like the first movie, but funnier.
Yeah, I will say this. It's funnier, it's more breezier, there's less of a villain. Like, it's kind of a nice core movie. But it's still, like, fun, breezy. I had a great time. The characters are much more evolved. There's a lot more funnier gags with the suit. There's... overall, it's a much more organized, much more cohesive, much more visually interesting than the last movie. And also, it's a fun movie. It is very small stakes, but I think after everything in Infinity War, you kind of need like a small, like, let's have fun. Only thing I'll say is don't watch the post-credit scene. Do not watch it. It'll kind of kill the mood. And also, you know what's going to happen. You know something. You know what's going to happen in those post-credit scenes without even watching it.
You're giving too much.
I'm telling them non-spoilery.
So anyway.
Yeah. It's good.
It's also the movie that they've now passed $17 billion in revenue.
And it's their 20th movie.
My biggest question is, does the guy from the first movie that explains how he got the information do it again? That montage where he's like, someone told me this, da, 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 da,
yes.
And then they told, they did it again?
Yes.
That's the greatest part. And I think when they do
And it's way funnier than anything in the first movie.
I feel like when they do Infinity Wars 2, they need to bring him back and have him do a recap of everything that's happened so far in Marvel. I just want him to explain it all, because it was the greatest scene ever.
Well, we'll find out in Infinity War Part 2 if he survived.
True.
Listen, Linda.
So, also, let's see here. Miss Marvel is coming out here soon.
Mm-hmm.
What are you guys' predictions on that? I think it's going to be really close to how Wonder Woman was.
I think they are going to do something with Thanos, but they're not going to do, like, anything big. Like, he may be the end credit sequence of that, because they have a history in the comics. They have a huge history in the comics.
But it's also set back in the 1990s.
Yeah. There's, like, so many ways that Infinity War ends in the comics and all of, like, the Infinity War-type storylines. Captain Marvel... is one of the endings for it. She is one of them that defeats Thanos in the comic books, but that's only one version. But it's not the version I think it's going to be. I think it's going to be the Soul Stone version.
It's a fair theory.
As far as Captain Marvel goes, you know, the more that is coming out about it, it does sound a little bit like Wonder Woman. I mean, she's... I mean, Miss Marvel is, like, a pilot. I'm assuming for, like, the latter end of the Gulf War?
Essentially. I think she's a test pilot.
Okay. So she is... So, I mean, she's in, like, a war thing, and then, you know... Of course, you know, she's gonna have her powers, and I think it's gonna be more... It's gonna eschew more towards space fantasy, because they're bringing back, like, Lee Pace's Ronan the Accuser. And, of course, in Guardians, Ronan and Thanos were working together until they broke up at in the end of Guardians of the Galaxy. And I guess it was a breakup.
I think it was more of a murder.
Thanos didn't kill Ronan. Or Ronan
no,
didn't kill Thanos.
But, you know. He was murdered.
But anyway... So, yeah, I mean, there's just going to be some things. We're going to see, obviously, you know, Samuel Jackson and, Clark Gregg in their prime, younger prime.
I don't know if you can... I don't know if he'll show up very long in the movie. I think he'll show up for maybe, like, a little tiny cameo.
Which one, Coulson or Fury?
Fury. Coulson, maybe, but Fury, we got to admit, you know, Samuel Jackson can play it a little bits at a time... But he's got some gray going on him, and you can't backtrack his age that well.
They're gonna de-age him.
You're gonna get that CGI, man.
Yeah, I would rather him just. I would rather him just come up clean shaven all the way around, no kind of goatee, and make a short, sweet, simple cameo instead of him being a major plot point. Just for the sheer fact of that, I don't.
So you want him to be like an end of Captain America kind of thing?
Yeah, that was great.
There for like a minute.
I liked that because it kind of gave him that espionage feel. When they have him in some of these movies where he's like, he's all over the place and he's one of the main characters doesn't show the action. It's like, that's fine, but that's not the Nick Fury I want. I want Nick Fury to be like a whisper on the wind and show up to call everybody in and then be gone. You know?
Mm-hmm.
That's where I feel like he shines as a character.
Jordan, you have a great point, but I think the last I heard is he's co-starring, not cameo.
Okay. Well,
all right, then.
We'll see what happens. Maybe they'll explain what happened to his eye.
Maybe.
All right. What else do we have we can talk about that's happened in movie news?
Incredibles 2 made over $500 million domestically, making it the most successful Pixar movie to date.
Mm-hmm.
And what else has gone on? Ocean's 8 has crossed over $100 million. I'm just going... what else? Oh, Carrie Russell is now in episode 9. For those who don't know who Carrie Russell is, she was Felicity for the longest time in the late 90s, early 2000s. And she's been kind of in some smaller roles here and there. She was in Mission Impossible 3 for like a split second. And then she was... and then she was in the Dawn for the Planet of the Apes. With Jason Clarke.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so she's been a staple of, like, character actresses, you know, getting into sci-fi stuff for a while. So now she's being added in, and there's a lot of debate on the internet if this is going to be Rey's mother in the movie, because they're both brunettes.
Yeah.
And to that I say, look, please don't, Abrams, please don't make that... Because, I mean, it contradicts everything that was already in episode 8, because in episode 8, it specified that her parents are dead and buried.
Well, that could have been him lying, too. Keep that in mind.
Yeah, but, damn, I like the idea.
I think she was more along the lines of, like, looking into the dark side of the Force than, like, her being controlled at that specific point. Like,
honestly,
get all these fan theories going on, man.
Honestly... Let it be. Let the parent thing be. Let it go. They're dead. They're buried. They were alcoholics. Rey is a nothing character that's thrust into this, you know, intergalactic war. Let it be. It makes her more cooler.
Fair enough. All right, so do we want to hit on a little world news? Do we want to talk about what's going on internationally? Maybe we haven't talked about it.
They got all the boys.
They got them all out?
They got all 12.
And the coaches. Yep, they're in medical care right now.
So if you've been living under a rock or in a cave,
or don't have Periscope.
Essentially, a group of Thai soccer players were led in by their coach into a cave system. Then they had a massive rain, and it trapped them in there. And they had to have divers go into these caves and drag them out. One diver died by drowning, and they got all the kids out now. But I'm pretty sure the coach is getting charged with child endangerment and numerous other charges. So he's probably...
Yeah. That was a really dumb mistake.
Like, Thai public enemy number one right now.
The problem is that it's during the raining season.
Yeah.
So their caves are going up and down with water.
And hints on season. It's not like, oh, we have light showers. You know, it's like, no, you have a few months of massive rains.
Monsoons, essentially.
Pretty much.
So, again, those caves, the water rises. I'm surprised the kids even lasted that long.
Oh, yeah, they were in there for, like, half a month.
I mean, it was the coach's mistakes for even thinking about taking those boys into the caves.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. I hope they get charged with more than that.
Well, we'll see. It's going to be a ongoing development. So, does anybody else have anything they want to talk about before we get to this interview at the end of this episode? It's a short one this week, mostly because we're still just trying to recoup through the summer. Once the summer kind of comes to an end, we'll be doing normal, longer episodes. But like I said, I've been on vacation, so that's why we haven't had one in a couple weeks. But anybody have any stories, anything going on, any events? I have a film this weekend I'm working on. I'll talk about that at the end.
Oh, Spider-Man 2 got a title. Spider-Man Far From Home.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's starting filming this week in New York.
Okay. Jared, do you got any projects you're working on currently you want to talk about?
Not currently that I'm willing to say yet.
Fair enough. Kayla, you got any films you've done recently or projects you're working on?
I was a part of the 48-hour film project for Atlanta a couple weekends ago, and our movie is premiering. If I don't know if when this episode's coming out, but our
today.
Movie is... Okay, it's premiering Thursday at 7 o'clock. We're Group E at the Midtown Art Cinema in Atlanta. Come check us out. We're team... Bad Symphony, and yeah, that's basically what I worked on. And then I worked on a film for Batigo Productions, Johnny Colorado, with our former friends, or I shouldn't say former, just our old friends, Philip and Michael from the Philip and Michael Show.
Yep, they used to be part of this network. I wish them much luck. They've been doing great. They have a new program going on.
Yep, the PMS Show.
Yep. Jared, you worked on a 48 as well.
Yes, I did. I was on Team I Forgot. That's the name of it.
Yeah.
we were in Group B and we're premiering Wednesday.
Do you guys want to kind of talk about for the viewers what the 48 entails real quick? I was almost on Jared's team, but they didn't need me. I was going to be their colorist. But like I said, I'm working on a project this weekend. I'll go in more into that in a second, but it is called Sucker. And it is with Omid as our director.
Right, so the 48-hour film festival is basically you're given exactly 48 hours from when they give you the information you need to turning it in. So you only have 48 hours to do pre-production, production, and any post-editing, color correction, anything in just 48 hours. What they do is that they give you a name of your character, what genre you are, so you can't really pre-plan around your genre. They give you a prop, and they give you a line you have to say. Am I missing anything?
Genre, character, prop, line. Yeah, I think that covers it.
So you have to base your script around those four things. Then you're given, you are given your genre, and then you have to make it, within 40 hours. Ours took an entire day. We went from... 5:30 a.m. For pickup at the Walmart. We got there about 6, and then we stopped working around, I think, 10-15. Just trying to get it all done one day, and we did it good. It looks great. I'm very happy with the way it turned out. And then they just did post for the rest of the day, and then you have to go drop it off in Atlanta.
Yeah, for me, I was the co-writer and producer of our movie, This Is For You, for Team Bad Symphony. And essentially, we already kind of created locations specific for our genre, or found locations beforehand. We casted beforehand, and that's really what you have to do beforehand, is just get cast in locations and crew. Everything else will just fall into play that Friday night. You do it. So yeah, we did. You know, we wrote the script on Friday, sent the call sheet out at like midnight, and then we filmed at three different locations. My Brandon's house, our director. We filmed in the back alleyway of M and Perk, and then we filmed in our friend Justin Mayhew's house for the horror scenes, since it was a dilapidated house. And then we posted all day Sunday and got there 45 minutes early at the counterpoint. But yes, in the 48-hour film project, the thing I love the most is it very much is a crash course in filmmaking for younger students or younger people. And if you are a younger person and you have $150 and you have like typical equipment, I recommend it. Like, it's a really good way of getting your hands deep into like learning how to make a movie. But yeah, that's all I gotta say. And when's your movie screening?
Wednesday night. We're Group B.
You're Group B?
Yeah.
Oh, yours is on Tuesday. Yours is on Tuesday.
We were told ours was going to be on Wednesday.
They have Group A and Group B are going on Tuesday.
Then somebody misinformed us.
Well, working on a film this weekend called Sucker. It's a capstone, and I will be their DIT. I've already started looking through it. It's a comedy set at a college in an apartment, and I'm excited to see how it turns out. It's been my first decent-sized project since I graduated. And Dead Winter is going to be getting a family and friends screening later this year.
October.
And then it'll be going to Sundance. So when we're able to release more information on that, we will. They've posted a lot of pictures, so if you're interested in looking it up, Dead Winter on Facebook.
And I think there's a trailer out, isn't it?
There is a trailer out. And it is spectacular. And I'm excited. We actually had an older professor we worked with, Professor Smith. He used to be the head of the radio station when we were associated with the college. He was the main editor, and I was assistant editor, and then right now it's going through all the VFX and sound effects, and it'll be finally colorized by Moonshine Post-Production, which I interned with before I graduated. So I'm excited to see how it turns out. So we're going to wrap this up. We're kind of at the 23-minute mark, and I'm going to tack on the interview at the end here with John Michael Hightower. He's a filmmaker from North Georgia, and he's going to talk a little bit about how he got into filmmaking and what he's working on. And we'll see you guys in a week or two. All right, this has been Jordan.
And Jared.
And Kale.
And we'll be right back with the interview. Here with John Michael. Go ahead and say hi.
Hello.
Okay, so we're going to be asking him some questions like we've done with all the other directors, producers, writers, and so on. And just get a little bit more about him and a little bit of insight on what it's like to be a director and writer and actor in the film industry.
And currently, on the indie side. Currently producer as well.
And producer as well. And I've heard you got a new project you're working on currently as well. So we'll be able to talk about that at the end.
Yes.
Okay, so we'll start off. What got you into film?
Oh, well, I have always been interested in film ever since I was a kid. You know, being a just younger and not very experienced with, you know, the business side of things, I always looked at the glamorous, more acting side of things. As like, I always wanted to be an actor, you know, I always looked at movies and TV shows and thought, oh, this must be the life, doing all that kind of stuff. And then, of course, you know, as I got older and noticed that there was more to it than that, I just slowly developed, I think it was in college actually, that I slowly developed my passion for writing and directing actually, and bringing full stories to life rather than just portraying it. I've never really actually lost my ability, well, I say ability, or my desire to act, but I think I've developed more of a passion for writing and directing and using other people's talents more as well. And I've started collecting film soundtracks and all that kind of stuff since an early age. I've got into the music portion of it as well, really developed an ear for film scores, for composers like Hans Zimmer and James Horner and Bruce Roland, Joseph LaDuca, Brian Tyler, you know, just to name a few. And, you know, it's as time has gone on and I've learned more about films and everything like that, I've grown more of a passion for editing as well. You know, and just kind of getting involved in the whole film process. My parents were not very supportive of me getting involved in the film industry because my mom tried to be an actress in the 70s and she failed at it, and she always felt that I would fail as well. And I'm like, you know, Mom, we live in a very different time period now. You know, just because Bonanza or Gunsmoke didn't want you back in the days doesn't mean that doesn't mean that we're not going to be successful. So I went for it, and you know, now they're just kind of sitting back and drumming their fingers and just, you know, watching what happens. And so I've got a lot of things to prove to a lot of people for sure.
Okay. And is there, you mentioned a couple people in the music industry and stuff like that have worked on film. Is there any movies directly that have influenced your career?
Oh, wow. Well, definitely Chris Nolan's Dark Knight trilogy. I mean, I think that's filmmaking at its very best. I mean, in my opinion, you know, that trilogy is really what launched the superhero franchise, I think, that we've kind of seen over the last 10 years. I think it pretty much started with that. Definitely the Jurassic Park franchise, now currently the Jurassic World trilogy that we're in. I mean, that was just a movie that you could only make one time, and it was just done so wonderfully well, and it's been continued so far. It has been continued very well, in my opinion.
But each film is also kind of part of its era when it comes out.
Absolutely, absolutely. You can definitely feel the 90s influence in the first Jurassic Park, and the first trilogy, and you can definitely feel a more modern, almost comic book feel to the Jurassic World kind of stuff. Also, the Rocky franchise, I love, you know, wrestling, I love boxing, I love, you know, the music in that, you know, when Rocky fights Hulk Hogan and Mr. T and all that kind of stuff. I love that entire franchise. I like what they're doing with Creed now. It's nice to see a character portrayed like Rocky Balboa. It's so cool to see Rocky portrayed from this 1970s all the way up to modern times. I think only one other actor, Jim Arness, who played Matt Dillon in Gunsmoke, I think only one other actor has had the privilege of playing the same character over 50 years. So
that's true.
Yeah, and Jim Arness played Matt Dillon from 1955 all the way to 1975 when the show ended. And then, of course, they made 5 made-for-TV movies with Jim Arness and Gunsmoke.
Well, to be more accurate, played the same character consecutively, because there's a lot of characters where they played their character and then there's been a time jump and they still played the same character, but it's like a cameo or something like that. He's done it consecutively in multiple films.
He's done it consecutively in multiple films and, you know, with a little bit of a time lapse. I mean, the 5 made-for-TV films that take place from 1987 to 1994, I believe, took place 2 years after he retired as the Marshal of Dodge. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's a little bit of a time jump. But, yeah, he plays the same character. And it's interesting to see how his character evolves over the censored era of the 50s, the crazy hippie generation of the 60s and 70s, and the very in-your-face modern-day individualism society of the 80s and 90s and today. And yet how much his character still remains the same, how much he's still true to the roots and everything like that. So I love franchises like that. Rocky, Jurassic Park, the Dark Knight trilogy, Gunsmoke, all of those original storytelling kind of franchises that have been redone, ripped up, rebuilt, overdone throughout each generation. So
what was the first film you worked on?
Oh, the first film I technically worked on? Oh, gosh. I don't know if this really answers the question as I'm going through my back history. I did a couple of commercials and music video in high school. When I got to college, I think the first film that I actually wrote and directed was a small piece for our psychology class. It was called Mother Knows Best. It was based on, speaking of Gunsmoke, it was based on a 1950s sitcom kind of a way. It was the first film and probably only film I'll ever do in black and white. It was trying to get that 1950s feel to it, and it was kind of comic. It was kind of a corny way of showing I had Aaron Harker play opposite me and my brother, and it was kind of a comic way of showing the benefits of studying versus not studying. Very simple concept. We didn't really go very far with it. I directed another smaller film in our cinematography class called Hall Pass. And then I did a couple of two or three silent films, part of my silent series, I call them. And then I started working on my first feature, which was Song for the Wounded. And there was a lot of firsts in there. There was a lot of firsts. My first acting job was for our friend Paul Glaze, who directed a film called Mixed Messages. And then I went on to do another film with Sarah Beth Moran, where I played a very interesting character, to put the least. So that was my first acting experience. I guess to technically answer your question, I think Mother Knows Best was probably my first actual film. So.
Okay.
But it's hard to categorize all these things because it was your first commercial. Is that considered a film? Or was it your first feature? Or what can you, what it is?
Whatever you consider.
Whatever you consider. That's right.
And speaking of what you consider, what would be your favorite moment on set? What is that moment where you're just like, this is why I'm happy I'm doing this? What is that moment where, or off set, or is there a moment in the filmmaking process where you go, this is, it's just in your heart, like, this is why I'm doing it?
Well, yeah, I think I'd have to say I really, really started to, the short films that I did previously, just it all happened too fast for this to really happen. But when I did Song for the Wounded, it was really, it was a very, it was very wonderful to see the cast's performance of their characters come to life. It was so humbling, in a sense, I guess you could say, when you take your script and you take your writing and you present it to your actors and they just deliver their interpretation of what their character would do. And it's 10 times, 50 times, 100 times better than anything you could have conceived.
Just seeing it come to life.
And you're just sitting here like, yes, this is so perfect. This is exactly what I envisioned, for Karen's character or Scotty's character. You know, this is totally what I envisioned, but just maybe had a hard time putting down on paper because it's hard to write scenes and make them perfectly realistic and make them, and just really just sitting back and just watching your actors just really, really bring your story to life in ways that you never really thought that you could. That is especially in the more faith-based stuff that I've done, you know, especially when you're really having a hard time delivering something that you think is going to be meaningful, but yet at the same time realistic. And that's where your actors come into play. They have to make the scene realistic. They have to make it work. And that's where they kind of pick up in their strengths where I'm weak in the writing.
And I think that resonates a lot throughout the entire industry, where you have a character or the best way I can think about it is when you do a transition from a book to a film,
mm-hmm.
and everyone has this built-up consciousness of what that character's like, and you have the perfect actor. And I think that's what you're referring to, is like mm-hmm. you have this world you have built in your head, and you have this character you want to see, and the person comes in and it's just like, yes, you are my fill-in-the-blank, because they're just, they fit it perfectly.
Mm-hmm. So many productions want to have that, and I've been lucky to have that for myself.
So what kind of stories do you like to tell?
Well, the short answer is good stories. The, you know, obviously I've kind of dabbled a little bit into the faith-based, kind of material where, you know, I had to very, very early on before I even, really kind of officially got involved in the industry, even starting in college, I knew very, very early on that it was going to be very, very difficult for me to do both secular and quote unquote Christian based filmmaking. It was going to be very difficult. And I always said, well, I'll just kind of do both. Shoot, I'll do both in the same movie. And it's been continuously proven to me how difficult that is, because, you know, you've got a secular audience that comes in and they want a certain thing. And you've got the faith-based audiences that come in and they want something different. And, you know, where you've got Song for the Wounded that's loosely Christian based and loosely, you know, but then you also have this abuse scene, and you also have, you know, the backstory about the two girls that is obviously less than perfect. So you're one of the complaints that I've gotten about trying to reach both audiences with the film is that I've failed and I've reached neither.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I keep thinking about Michael W. Smith, who I met him back in about a few years back. I remember what he said in a 1992 interview from his Change Your World tour, his Change Your World album. He said, I don't write a record for the Christian market or the pop market. I just make a record. But, you know, my faith is the most important thing to me, and I write everything from a spiritual perspective. I'm a pop artist. I grew up on the Beatles and Elton John, you know, and I grew up in this quote-unquote Christian environment. And, you know, all my songs have to be quote-unquote religious. I don't really look at it that way. And I don't look at it the same way either. I don't really make a story for the Christian market or the secular market. I make a story, but I do have to consider the audience, and I do have to consider what kind of people are going to be seeing. So I've done secular stuff. I'm working on a secular project right now that has nothing to do with religion at all. And, but yet I'm keeping it clean, making sure that it still stays within, you know, a certain, you know,
it feels right to you.
It feels right to me, and that it's getting the point across. It's reaching a secular audience. It's telling a good story without compromising necessarily any values.
So, as a director, is there any elements, styles, or cinematics that you employ in your films that are characteristic of your films?
So, basically, what you're saying is what my the head of the music department at school, Dr. Marker, he would say, what is the something, a style of films that everyone would recognize, this is John Michael's film. Mm-hmm. Besides there being a lot of yellow in each film that I do, I guess there is a good sense of genre crossing that I tend to do. You know, as you're watching Song for the Wounded, you're thinking, oh, I'm watching this nice little Hallmark movie and all that kind of stuff. And all of a sudden we take this nosedive into when the flashback scene happens, into this dark David Lynch kind of mm-hmm. film. And then we come out of that, and then we win in this triumphant Jerry Bruckheimer almost kind of feel in the end. And you know, and a lot of people have said, you know, find a genre and stick with it. I'm just like, I don't really know if good stories don't necessarily have to stick with one genre. That's something that Hollywood's kind of.
And not all directors stick with the same genre.
Not all directors stick with the same genre, for sure. I mean, now I'm having a hard time finding examples of when directors have kind of switched genres, so to speak, within the same film. But I think I've got a strong argument that many different directors do many different types of genre films. I think one of the things is being genre crossing, you know, not necessarily sticking with one stereotypic type of movie, and just letting the story kind of, you know, lead the way and just let the music and let the tonality and let all that kind of stuff follow. Does it feel like the same movie all the way through? Not necessarily, but I don't really know if it needs to.
It's very Shakespearean, where he'd bring in elements of tragedy, elements of romance, elements of comedy, and you need a little bit of all that to make a story.
There you go. And a lot of people are going to have different opinions about how the story needs to be told. And, you know, as an independent filmmaker, I feel the privilege to take the liberty of telling it differently than a typical... I mean, there's basically, if you look at Hollywood films now, there's basically four different types of films that are being released right now. Comic book movies, mm-hmm. horror movies, sequels to already successful franchises, and your upbeat, animated... Disney-type films. The only films that are being released right now.
I think
now.
The fifth one, that would be the ones going for a certain demographic. So you have like the... what's his name? Tyler Perry. Mm-hmm. His films go towards a certain demographic.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a lot of those kind of films like Get Out with Jordan Peele. That one, I think, is a wonderful film, but it is going towards a certain demographic. And it's still trying to tell a point. And I definitely recommend it to anyone that watches it.
Yeah. So I'm not quite sure exactly how to fully answer that question. I don't know if I've, in just the few films, I've got Song for the Wounded. I've got a TV pilot episode called Dark Intentions coming out. I got a short film about depression called Down in the Dumps. And I'm trying to eventually get around to my comedic TV episode, excuse me, called Art of the Deal, but just haven't had a chance to get there just yet. And I'm not quite sure what tying factor is going to go into all of those, but maybe that might be something that y'all decide. Maybe that might be something y'all watch all of those different films and be like, now what's something common, something that you can tell that I wouldn't be able to tell?
And sometimes it takes a little while. Like Wes Anderson, it took a while for him to get his stride and work with his DP and his editors and producers, mm-hmm. where he has a feel. And you watch his films and you go, that is a Wes Anderson film.
To give you an answer besides the dumb yellow thing that I just mentioned earlier, I guess you could say really good sunset scenes. I always take sunset scenes for mood purposes, and I usually shoot them with my iPhone because my iPhone picks up more of what my eyes sees, and I incorporate them into just about every film that I've done, especially the more dramatic ones.
Fair enough. So, is there a favorite film you've worked on?
Well, obviously, I'm most proud of Song for the Wounded at this point because it's just, I mean, Song for the Wounded will always be my first. It was my first feature. I think musically, I don't think I'm ever going to be able to come up with anything different or better than that musically. Cinematically, audio-wise, absolutely. You know, it was a work in progress. It was a learning experience. Like mainly, it was just me and my DP doing multiple jobs pretty much through that entire process. Now that I have more of a crew, you're going to definitely expect to see more quality products coming out from a production standpoint. But from a storyline standpoint and from, you know, music standpoint, I definitely think Song for the Wounded has definitely been my strongest project so far. And I definitely think that it's exactly the kind of message and exactly the kind of story that I want to tell. And it's I'm announcing that we're making a sequel to it. Probably going to start production for that sometime this summer. And it's going to be completely different. It's going to be completely some of the same characters, some of the same themes, but it's going to rely on mainly different characters and different backstories and conquer some other themes we didn't get a chance to conquer in the first one. So
fair enough. So. What are you currently working on? You mentioned a couple of them. Do you want to go in depth on any of the films or TV shows you're working on?
So I, after Song for the Wounded, that was mainly a lot of Atlanta's Christian acting talent that I had working on that. And they had reached the pinnacle of their free projects, I guess, that they're working on, because Song for the Wounded was pretty much a zero budget film, believe it or not. So I went on to look for other talent and look for other, you know, opportunities, and kept a lot of the same ones, of course, you know, that were kind of on my team as well. I met a really, really talented young actress in Nashville named Cheyenne Petty, who I've very much had the pleasure of working with. We sat down and definitely we're on the same page with a lot of things. So I casted her in my next my next TV pilot episode called Dark Intentions, which is a story about a private eye who was formerly a cop who got busted for just giving into temptation that a lot of beat coppers at the time would have given into, and his partner had to testify against him, and now he's kind of out doing his own thing and dealing with his own and he's not usually gotten a case of this magnitude that he gets in the beginning of the episode, and he realizes that the missing girl that he's supposed to go after was one of the victims that he found in a previous roundup that he had had a brief relationship with, mm-hmm. and it doesn't we don't really go into why the relationship with her didn't work, but they meet each other again, and we find out towards the end of the episode that it was her father framing him the entire time. So some things we will uncover, and some things we will leave open for, you know, like I said, the rest of the series if it gets made. And there's also a short film I'm doing about depression. I've always wanted to tackle that issue. And the reason I chose to go with the short film style is because everyone's been telling me, make a short film, make a short film. Okay, I'll make a short film. So I decided to do probably about a 20 to 30 minute short film about this one girl's story to find herself and why she is the way she is, counterparting with her best friend who seems to have it all. Liz Bachman is the actress that we have playing Christy, the main character, and she has done such a fantastic job with it. And very excited to see the finished project. And you know, it's going to be kind of like a PSA, kind of a depression awareness kind of thing to kind of educate the public on, especially college age. I mean, this is obviously very much written for a college age type audience. Still clean though, actually, if you can imagine that. So, and then I've got a comedic project called Art of the Deal that I'm going to try to eventually get shot in there somewhere. It's not taking precedence right now. I've got raising funds for Song for the Wounded 2, which I expect that to be absolutely fantastic, and I'm really looking forward to the new talent and the new bringing back Tristan Crow as Scotty Ferguson. He'll have a much better, much more bold part of the story kind of role this time. Hopefully we'll be bringing back Kate Barnett as Scarlett and making most of the story about her. I've got a few new contestants rounding out the roster, and one thing that we didn't do in the first film that we definitely are going to do in the second film is make, hopefully with the Scarlett character, if we can get Kate on board, is hopefully take a bitter showdown till the very end. Like the contestants really kind of showdown with each other up until the very end, and yet just before the very end there's this sense of, well, I'm not gonna go into it, I'm gonna let everybody be surprised. I got one more feature in the works about a couple who are having problems and they try to move on, and let's just say love may surprise them. So got those two in the works. And some things along the lines may come up as well, but those are the planned ones anyway.
Okie dokie. Now I have a surprise question for every single person that I do on this interview series. For the listeners, this is actually a take two of this. We had another one, but we had a hard drive fail, and that was my bad, but we're trooping through it. So I got a new question for them to keep them off guard. So your question is, if you could be the understudy and or director's assistant to any director in history on a film, who would it be?
Ooh, just one, huh?
One director. You can choose any director and you can watch them, work with them, see everything they're doing.
Well, I love Steven Spielberg, but I'm not really huge on his choice of music, with always having John Williams do his scores. Now, I love Ridley Scott's movies. I love the fact that he works with Hans Zimmer very often. Same for Tony Scott. May he rest in peace. Same for directors like, you know, Ron Howard and Antoine Fuqua. But I really like the style of storytelling that Spielberg does. I guess I'd have to go for Spielberg, and just because he manages to be so successful, but yet keep his films so incredibly clean, and he was an underdog. He was, I think he was actually rejected from film school because his student projects were just that bad.
And if you look back on his filmography with, you know, Jaws and all the Indiana Jones series and stuff like that, mm-hmm. he's definitely made a name for himself.
Schindler's List.
And Schindler's List is a really good one in that as well. He's got quite impressive filmography, actually.
He does.
It'll be a very interesting day, not to say I hope for this, but when he dies, just to see what happens to all of his films and how it changes that. I would love to see a master grouping of all of his films together.
Yeah, hopefully that won't happen for a long
time. Oh, yeah. I hope he keeps making films. So, is there any shout-outs you want to do? Any social media you want to plug? Any one you want to thank or talk about?
Well, let's see. There's so many. I want to thank, obviously, my cast and crew for Song for the Wounded. We just finished that together. We're very, very proud of that project. And I look forward to seeing most of you on the second one. We're gonna make something, hopefully something twice as good. Better pacing. We're going to do something different with the music this time. More montage performances. I'd like to give a shout out to Cheyenne Petty, who's one of my new actresses, who drives all the way down from Nashville to be a part of my films. And that speaks very, very highly to me. And it's I just hope that my writing and my projects do her justice, because she's got incredible talent. I want to give a shout out to all of my cast and crew for the next two projects that we're working on. My DP for Dark Intentions, Mason Guevara. My DP for Down in the Dumps, Amanda Garner. And my first assistant camera on both projects, Carly June Payne. Just thank you so much for what you guys do. I would be nothing without you guys. I mean literally nothing. Just shout out to everybody at school who's been very, very very supportive and understanding that I am not perfect and I do make mistakes, including you, Jordan. So, Dr. Marker and Brian Arms, James McKenzie, professors at school who have kind of helped train me and get me to where I am, and at the same time tell me that I'm going too fast, I'm cranking out too much material, slow down, but yet still been very supportive of what I've done. And it's very humbling, and it's very I've had to avoid getting emotional like four times during this interview. That's why my voice is so low and so and mainly just shout out to God for giving me the opportunity to do all this. Like I said previously in the last interview, I said that if you don't believe in God, get involved in the film industry, because you were just telling me earlier about a film that you just did that failed, and I don't know if I should mention that on the air, but...
No, it's fine.
You can take it out if you need to.
No, it's okay.
Someone mentioned to me about a film that failed previously.
I'll elaborate on it. We had a film that we did a while back that was a short that it just so many production problems came up that we were unable to complete it. And it's interesting to see how, like, even though it failed, we all learned something from it and you continue on. That's the way that kind of works in this industry, where you... Whether it's a successful movie, whether it's a flop, whether it's the greatest thing since sliced bread, or it's something that just gets thrown into a playlist somewhere and someone puts it on the background, doesn't pay attention to it. You made a film. You've made something that goes down in history. Mm-hmm. And if you're putting content out there that is respectable and it is wholesome, and whether it be creepy or funny or loving or dramatic, it's still
creepingly wholesome. Interesting.
But it's E.T.'s technically a horror movie.
Yeah. Okay, you made your point. Yeah,
so it's one of those where whatever you're making, as long as you're making something, you're changing history.
Exactly. And a lot of people considered Song for the Wounded a failure as well, because because of the audio issues, and they just felt like I had a real chance to make something there and I just didn't do it. I'm just like, and a lot of the things they really said bad about it was that a lot of the preparing that I did for the second one, where I didn't quite go into Scarlett's character enough, well, all that was going to be handled in the second one. They're just like, you shouldn't have done that. You should always do for the first film. But anyway, I was saying shout out to God for getting me to a point where, you know, I have been able to finish all of my projects and I have no, technically no failed projects on my list. I mean, you know, I think we can go back and, you know, tweak a few, and I have actually gone back and tweaked a few before I've released them. But it's very humbling to know that, you know, even though there's a lot of doubt about where I am and where I'm supposed to be going in this world and how much impact I'm supposed to be having on people, it's good to know that there's a path being laid out in front of me. And that's probably one of the only things that's definitely kept me going throughout this crazy thing called life, is just seeing that there is a plan behind what's going on here, and all I need to do is just continue to stay on the path and do things right, and then just wait for things to unfold. Which at 33 years old, with a lot of failures behind me and a lot of unsupportive family, that's difficult. It is, but all we can really do is just keep moving forward and just wait for the divine to reveal our destiny, I guess we could say.
That's very well put.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right, so we're going to wrap this up, and we'll be back next week with another writer, director, actor, whatever it is, as long as they're a creator. And we'll be talking to them, and if you want to know anything more about him, I'll be putting a description down at the bottom, and we will be back next week. This has been Jordan.
And John Michael. Thank you very much, everyone.
Have a good night.